Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the presidential race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in terms of the intellectual versus the anti-intellectual, and assess the extent to which the Clinton campaign smugly takes comfort from Trump's daily bomblets of political incorrectness and fact-free pronouncements, instead of understanding the anger, disgust, and disillusionment that drove people to vote for Bernie Sanders and underpins support for Donald Trump. Michael Lind, the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the author of Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States, joins us to discuss his article at The Smart Set, Intellectuals Are Freaks, Why Professors, Pundits, and Policy Wonks Misunderstand the World, and whether being the smartest person in the room is a help or hindrance in the 2016 elections. Then we will speak with Joel Rogers, a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and author of American Society, How It Really Works. He joins us to discuss the Trump rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin, at which Donald Trump read a prepared text endorsing House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senator John McCain in an apparent act of contrition orchestrated by Paul Ryan's friend, the RNC chair, Reince Priebus. With right-wing activists like Ann Coulter actively campaigning against Ryan's re-election in Tuesday's Wisconsin primary, we will examine how this Rust Belt state could end up being the key to who wins the election. Then finally, we'll look into the remarks by the former acting director of the CIA, Mike Morrell, who called Donald Trump an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation, and assess why Vladimir Putin appears to be trying to help elect Trump when the smart money is on Hillary Clinton winning handily. A former senior staffer on both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, Locke Johnson, the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia and author of The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War, joins us to discuss Putin's undisguised dislike for Hillary and why she and President Obama should try to reach out to the Russian leader. And joining us now is Michael Lind, who is a co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. He's the co-author of The Radical Center, The Future of American Politics, and Made in Texas, George W. Bush and the Southern Takeover of American Politics. Among his other nonfiction books are The American Way of Strategy and What Lincoln Believed. And his latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. And his latest article at The Smart Set is Intellectuals Are Freaks, Why Professors, Pundits, and Policy Wonks Misunderstand the World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Lind.
Thank you.
And of course, it's a little bit of an irony, is it not, Michael, that here I am today talking to a bunch of professors.
So, well, as I say in my article, I've spent my entire career in one of the three categories of academic, policy, wonk, or journalist. So what I mean by intellectuals are freaks is we intellectuals, and it's about us, we intellectuals are statistical aberrations in the U.S. or, for that matter, in any other society. And that has always been the case for people who make a living by dealing with or discussing ideas, whether it was theologians in the Middle Ages or academics and journalists and policy experts today.
So, as you point out, the people who specialize in the life of ideas tend to be extremely atypical of their societies, and for generations, populists of various kinds have argued that intellectuals are unworldly individuals out of touch with the experience and values of most of their fellow citizens. Do you see that dichotomy in the Trump versus Hillary Clinton campaign?
Yes, I do. Now, I don't think this is anything new. I think if we went back, you know, to 1916 or 1816, you would find most of the intellectuals of the day came from very affluent, educated backgrounds. And if anything, in the past, they had less contact. We're more meritocratic now than we used to be. But what you see particularly warping the media coverage, and I think this is because of the professional bias of intellectuals who got to where we are by getting the right answer and scoring well on tests, is this kind of gotcha approach on facts. And this has risen in the last decade or two to become what I think is kind of dangerous. So instead of acknowledging that the other side has different values than yours, you simply have played this gotcha game where, oh, you're wrong on this, you know, or you got that decimal wrong or this statistic is wrong. And the pretense is that there's this one group in American society, which happens to be kind of centrist liberals, who are just well-informed. And everyone else, whether they're Bernie Sanders leftists or Donald Trump populists, they're just ignorant. And if only they were better educated, they would agree with the kind of, you know, Clinton wing of the Democratic Party. And I think that's a very dangerous trend.
Well, Senator Moynihan once famously said that people are entitled to their own opinions about their own facts. But surely one of the problems here in the American political discourse is that facts are a moving target. He who spins the truth the best wins the arguments. And frankly, people do reality shopping. Liberals get their reality from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox, Christians from Christian Broadcasting, etc. And there's no consensus on what is true anymore. So how do you navigate that?
It actually doesn't matter that very much outside of, you know, a few areas. You know, climate change would be one area where it matters. But the vast majority of divisions between right, left, and center, when it comes to policy issues, should you raise taxes on the rich or not? Should you spend money on the poor, or is this reducing their willingness, you know, to work, or is it just morally wrong? These are actually values differences. And so let's assume tomorrow that every conservative agreed with liberals on the science of global warming, and that every socialist agreed with centrist liberals on the costs of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Would that mean everyone would be a Clinton Democrat? I don't think so. I think those value differences are much more fundamental. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't point out, prevarication or error or deliberate falsehood when it comes to data, but it simply is not the case that what distinguishes the right, the left, and the center is primarily disagreement about facts rather than fundamentally different values.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Lind, who is a co-founder of the New America Foundation and policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. And his latest article at The Smart Set is Intellectuals Are Freaks, Why Professors, Pundits, and Policy Wonks Misunderstand the World. So when you point out in your article, Michael Lind, that only about 30% of American adults have a four-year undergraduate degree, is that then just going back to the Trump-Clinton presidential race, does that mean that there's a majority out there, a potential majority for Trump? Because as I mentioned in my opening, there is a certain detectable level of smug comfort that Hillary Clinton and her campaign are taking from Donald Trump. They're largely framing their campaign around his mistakes, and that's what their commercials show. But they don't appear to understand the anger, disgust, and disillusionment that drove people to vote for Bernie Sanders and underpin support for Donald Trump.
Well, I think there's a danger for the Democrats that by boasting that they're the party of the college educated, they're going to offend most of their own constituents who do not have four-year college diplomas. Particularly their core base, African-Americans, is proportionately less educated than the non-Hispanic white population. And that's also true of Latinos, though not of Asian-Americans. I think it's kind of dangerous for, and until recently, for the entire 20th century, the first part of the 21st, the Republican Party got most college-educated voters because the Republicans were the party of the affluent elite. Now Democrats are winning over the college-educated and the affluent. But, you know, to my mind, this should be raising questions as to who is representing the working class and it's being portrayed not as a class thing, but as a matter of information. If you have a college degree, then you're a high-information voter. If you have a high school diploma or less, like the vast majority, I should say, of Democratic voters, then you're a low information voter whose views can be ignored. So I think this, you know, the sword of the low information voter as an accusation can cut both ways.
But when you talk about people's values are more important there and more of an indicator than who truth is believed, the Republicans have for the longest time used dog whistle coded messages in effect to keep racism alive, to exacerbate rather than heal divisions. It seems to be a fairly obvious strategy that as long as people talk about abortion and values and prayer in school and all these extraneous things that no other modern democracy considers an important part of the political discourse, as long as people are distracted by those issues and guns and other things, they don't focus on the bread and butter issues and what they have in common, as opposed to and the recognition that one of the biggest challenges in America is whether or not we can maintain vestiges of democracy as we more and more become an oligarchy.
Well, but that's true of the donor elite and the political establishments in both parties, not just the Republicans. The Democrats are constantly looking for new social issues or cultural issues, along with the old ones, to change the subject from the fact that the mainstream Democratic approach to trade, to entitlement cut, so on, until fairly recently, was really that of moderate conservatives on economics. So every 4 years, Democratic voters are told that there will be a Supreme Court majority and gay rights will be taken away and abortion will be outlawed again and so on, because it serves the interest of the mainstream Democrats as well as the establishment Republicans to focus. See, what both of them are trying to do is the base of both parties are the most downscale people in the United States. It's working class whites. And it's working class and poor African Americans in the case of the Democratic Party. And so both the establishment Democrats and the establishment Republicans have to mobilize these guys to get out to vote. And they do so in the case of coded racism and in the case of Republicans, but also by whipping up fear of the Ku Klux Klan and so on to absurd levels in the case of Democrats. So I think both of them use race and gender politics, you know, and then, of course, once they're elected, they will happily work together to pass the TPP, right? Yeah. Or to cut Social Security, which President Obama offered to do with the Republican Congress. So I don't think a single party is guilty of that kind of manipulation. I think they both are.
So does that mean then, given that Hillary Clinton her campaign seems to be feeling that they've more or less got the Bernie people, or most of them, I think Jill Stein's Green Party is now polling at about 5%, and the Libertarians are polling at about 10%, and I think you can fairly split the Libertarians in half in terms of who would potentially vote for Democrats and Republicans. So I'm not they're not certainly below their 15% threshold to join the debates get on. Well, I think the Libertarians, I think, are on most of the ballots. I think the Greens are only on about 23%. So let's start with that premise. Do you think that's going to be a factor? Is this race going to be a lot closer, or is Hillary Clinton, as appears to be, feeling comfortable that she's got the Bernie people and that allows her to reach out to disaffected Republicans?
No, I think she will probably win with a comfortable margin, because the parallel are these multi-party European systems where you get a party of the nativist working class anti-immigrant right, like the French National Front or the Sweden Democrats. In Sweden, in those systems where you have three or four parties, the mainstream parties coalesce into a coalition, either in the president or in the case of France, the second round of presidential voting, to freeze out the national populist equivalent of Trump. So I think the Democrats are prudently building a kind of omnibus coalition that has everybody from Michael Bloomberg, Republicans and independents, to Bernie Sanders, socialists, to about Trump. The problem is, the day after Clinton wins, that coalition starts falling apart because it makes no sense except to, as a coalition, to thwart a particular candidacy.
So when you mention in your article, Michael Lynn, intellectuals are freaks, why professors, pundits, and policy wonks misunderstand the world, that contemporary intellectuals are unlikely to live and work in the places where they are born. In contrast, the average American lives about 18 miles from his or her mother. How does that translate into the electorate? Because, you know, we do have this sort of these rural electorates that do have disproportional power. You've got the electoral college that reflects that. Is that a factor? In other words, do all of the intellectuals end up living in New York City or Los Angeles?
Well, I think, you know, obviously there is a media elite concentrated in New York City, Washington, D.C., L.A., to some extent, San Francisco. And it's overwhelmingly centrist Democrat. It's not left-wing Democrat, but it's kind of centrist Democratic. And it's so thorough and so universal that it's not a matter of consciously scheming to promote Democratic centrism. It's just they're all centrist Democrats. And I just say this on the basis of 30 years of experience. And so what that means is you get this kind of groupthink in the mainstream media, and the outsiders, either they find a countercultural media organ like it used to be Fox, but now that the junior Murdochs seem to be moving it in a more moderate direction, maybe it will be Breitbart, you know, for the populist right, you know, and, you know, various small radio stations and magazines for people who are left of the Democratic center. And that's bad because the minorities who are not represented, they become targets for, I came across this great phrase somebody used, conflict entrepreneurs. Isn't that a great phrase? So the conflict entrepreneurs want to rile them up in order to sell ads or to sell products or you know, to get eyes or clicks. And that's one of the things that has happened to the conservative subculture. As I've argued for a number of years, the conservative subculture in the United States is now a counterculture. It's simply whatever the mainstream culture is for, they tend to be against. So it's not actually something that is integrated into the system that can supply a shadow government that can take power. And the same thing, to some degree, is true on the left. And I just think that's bad for the country when all of these views, which represent left or right tens of millions of voters, do not have, you know, responsible mainstream people being represented in what they read or what in the op-ed pages or the people talking on TV. There's just this kind of one point of view. And so therefore, they go to the more extreme examples of that point of view, who may be too extreme.
Well, Michael Lind, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Lind, who's the co-founder of the New America Foundation and the policy director of New America's Economic Growth Program. His latest book is Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. And his latest article at the Smart Set is Intellectuals Are Freaks, Why Professors, Pundits, and Policy Wonks Misunderstand the World. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Rust Belt state of Wisconsin could end up being the key to who wins the election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joel Rogers, who's a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's written widely on American politics and public policy in such books as On Democracy, Right Turn, The Forgotten Majority, What Workers Want, and most recently, American Society, How It Really Works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joel Rogers.
Nice to be here, Ian.
And Joel, given that Donald Trump had a big rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin on Friday, at which he read a prepared text somewhat, it felt like he wasn't particularly enthusiastic, endorsing House
Speaker. He didn't seem very enthusiastic, did he?
Well, I think he likes to just be off the cuff, and they're trying to clearly, sort of corral him into being more of a politician and less of a of a showman. But this prepared text, of course, endorsed House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senator John McCain, and it was an apparent act of contrition orchestrated by Paul Ryan's friend, the RNC chair, Reince Priebus. So you've got in your state now, you've got right-wing activists like Ann Coulter and the Breitbart people actively campaigning against Paul Ryan's re-election in Tuesday's primary in Wisconsin. They're making a lot of noise. They're picketing his house along with the tattooed fellow that's running against him. What's the expectation? The pundits give Ryan something like 80% chances of winning.
Yeah, I give him about a 99% chance of winning.
So what would your advice be to Ann Coulter?
Please go away. Get a life, please. Yeah. And, you know, we've had too much already.
So
same with Breitbart, for that matter. But that's just my view.
Well, Breitbart dropped dead some time ago. So
Okay.
But in any case, given, I mean, how much does Wisconsin, as I suggested, seems to be shaping up as a key Rust Belt state? Everybody says that's Trump's only chance, that if he could win the states that Romney won, along with the Rust Belt states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Indiana, and Pennsylvania, then he could be a threat. And you've got a key Senate race there with Johnson against the former senator Russ Feingold. You've got the head of the RNC being from Wisconsin, along with Paul Ryan, the speaker, who some people think could still end up being the presidential candidate if Trump takes a walk. So am I correct in suggesting that we should be watching Wisconsin?
Well, I'm all for giving attention to Wisconsin. I happen to live here, so I like attention like everybody else. I don't see it as a bellwether state or particularly a swing state. I think it's still going to go. I think it will go pretty solidly for Hillary. It won't be a landslide. Democratic-Republican breakdowns in the state are never landslides. Even Tommy Thompson, the fantastically popular former governor, I don't think ever got even close to, one election he did get close. He got close to landslide votes, like 60%, close to that. But in most of the elections, it's usually 53-47, one way or another, sometimes Republican, sometimes Democratic. The state's often been accused of schizophrenia because, we have, at one point we had two quite liberal Democratic senators, and, meanwhile we're electing Tommy Thompson, and, it goes back and forth. But if you're looking for predictions, which is a fool's errand, I would think that Hillary's going to win Wisconsin and that Russ will beat Johnson in the Senate. I'm less hopeful about what's going on in the state legislature, but that's probably not of concern to a national audience. Although it's of great concern to me because it affects the operation of the state government enormously.
Well, hasn't the governor gone after the University of Wisconsin and eviscerated one of the state's great institutions?
He has gone resolutely after what is, I think, by anyone's view, the sort of flagship institution, public institution in the state, which is very sad. I happen to teach there, so it's maybe particularly sad for me, but it's bad for the state, really bad for the state, because the university brings in a lot of money, it generates a lot of knowledge. you know, we have a chronic brain drain here because we produce a bunch of well-trained kids and then they leave the state because they don't see many opportunities here. But to seize on that as a reason not to fund the university instead of, you know, building more opportunity here, which is what the Republicans in general have done in the past several years, is, to my mind, very, very foolish and short-sighted.
But
increasingly, you're hearing that, actually, from business people in the smaller towns in particular that they claim as their base. They just think the state has really overreached its almost vengeful attack on the university. It's sort of absurd. You should know here, Ian, that the university is vastly overdeveloped. It's all over the state. There are 27 campuses, basically. So there's almost no town that's not proximate to one branch or another of the University of Wisconsin. And so it's very widely distributed. And I don't know, if I were, you know, even Scott Walker, you know, and I wanted to grow the state, I would be a little bit more like Tommy Thompson. He used to always look to the university for cooperation on his economic development plans. But Walker has, you know, famously just, you know, keep them out of my face. It's not just Madison. It's also Stevens Point and Appleton, all the other campuses.
But isn't it true that Governor Scott Walker prides himself on not having a college education, has a kind of venal and vengeful attitude towards the university, and there in Madison, everybody had a bumper sticker, recall Walker, and there he is, you know, surrounded like Fort Apache in his own capital. So I was wondering whether that...
I was one of those Native Americans or Injuns or whatever you want to call them who was part of the surrounding. It was a very peaceful thing. It was not particularly threatening. We were simply asking him not to obliterate the public service commission in Wisconsin.
But it's
relatively peaceful stuff.
Sure, but it ties into what I was talking about with Michael Lind, the premise that this election this race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is a sort of a race of the intellectual versus the anti-intellectual. And that whether or not the Clinton campaign smugly takes comfort from Trump's daily bomblets of political incorrectness and fact-free pronouncements, instead of understanding the anger, disgust, and disillusionment that drove people to vote for Bernie Sanders and underpins support for Donald Trump. So do you accept that thesis?
Well, I only came on the last few words that Michael was speaking, but I'm a great admirer of his work, and I certainly agree that the Democratic Party is... it has lost it in all sorts of ways. It's lost it in the way that, Brad DeLong and Steve Cohen recently said it just sort of was overtaken by ideology over pragmatism. It sort of lost its touch for growing the economy in a way that would benefit people broadly and has failed utterly to deliver much to the working class in the last 40 years. I think we all know that. And to the extent that they're still, and they've lost repeatedly in saying, oh, he's so stupid. You know, I remember saying that around Ronald Reagan, or people saying that about Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter was so much smarter than Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan couldn't possibly lose or couldn't possibly win. It's an absurd argument. It's insulting to the people that see those people as their leader. It's stupid for the party. I don't think the party gets anything by saying we're smarter than you are. So if that's partly what Michael was saying, absolutely, absolutely.
But do you see that in Hillary Clinton? She seems to be framing her campaign around showing clips of all of the things that Trump has said rather than addressing the underlying anger that propels his voters and that also propelled Bernie Sanders' voters. And she and Obama are putting out all these rosy stories about how wonderful the economy is. And frankly, I don't think people in these Rust Belt states feel that way.
No, they very clearly do not. And that's not just it's not just the people that people like to say is the base of Trump support. Of course, Trump has a bunch of truly racist and horrible people who are voting for him. But he's got a lot of other people who are, God-fearing, non-racist, reasonable people that would make for good neighbors if they were, if you're living next to them. And they just think, you know, they can't stand Hillary personally. And of course, that's excessively demonized by the conflict entrepreneurs and a bunch of other people. But they do think the Democratic Party is standing for a bunch of elite interests that are not speaking to their condition. And I think, essentially, they're right to think that. The question is whether you want to then abandon the Democratic Party rather than try to improve it in some way, you know, maybe get, you know, a third party in, or get some sort of fusion politics in or something. I mean, it's the Common Sense Coalition or something. If you want to abandon the Democratic Party altogether and choose this alternative, which is, I think, truly loony. Trump is, I think, a terrible danger to the country, despite my tremendous disappointment with Democratic performance. So I'm voting for Hillary. You know, I voted for Bernie in the primary here, and happily so, or reasonably happily so, and I'll vote for Hillary. You know, I'm not even holding my nose, because Trump is such a threat to, you know, American politics really cracking apart in ways that are, you know, not very attractive. I mean, we were talking the other day, you know, I'm sort of with Tyler Cowen on this. There's been 20% of the American public that's been sort of nuts for a very, very long time, but they used to be split relatively neatly between the Democrats, you know, say, reactionary, you know, anti-black Democrats in the South that never forgave them historically, you know, never forgave Lincoln for, you know, for freeing the slaves, and then they all moved to the Republican Party, having never forgiven Johnson for, you know, giving people a right to vote and you know, move up. And then there are sort of semi-libertarian types, largely in the West, I think, that were in the Republican Party. But now they're both in the Republican Party, and it's a major fraction of the Republican Party. And, you know, about 40% of the Republican Party. And, you know, the Republican Party has used them in a very abusive way for a very long time, but very successfully, exploiting their, you know, their fears and their angers in often coded language. And Trump has taken the code off, you know, and he calls out people in racist ways and sexist ways and disgusting ways. But, you know, this is something the Republican Party owes to itself. Trump is clearly a creature of the relatively reactionary forces. The Republicans have been very careful to keep roiled up and angry for a very, very long time.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Joel Rogers, the Green Party's having its convention over this weekend, and they're polling at about 5%, the Libertarians at about 10%. They need to get to 15% to be included in the debates. So if you do the math, you figure half the Libertarians would perhaps vote Democrat and the other half Republican. So, you know, could be up to 10% that's shaved off Hillary, which, if it's close, could mean something. But in general, you know, I remember talking with Bernie Sanders before, when at the point where he's about to put his foot in the race, and he said to me, "Look, you know, I don't want to be a spoiler like Nader was in Florida. I'm going to, you know, run as a Democrat." And it's pretty odd to me that people would, the Bernie people would be voting for Jill Stein, not following the lead of their own leader, Bernie, because I think he understands, as I think is pretty clear. In other words, if the Tea Party Republicans can capture the Republican Party, there's no reason why progressive Democrats can't capture the Democratic Party and take it away from the donor class. And Bernie Sanders almost did. So is that the lesson, or should that be the lesson?
Yeah, I think that should be the lesson. I think it would be wise to have some sort of ginger faction inside the Democratic Party, or effectively inside the Democratic Party, willing to go out if need be. You know, something like a Working Families Party, or what the Working Families Party is in several states, or the Common Sense Coalition that, you know, may be emerging, or a variety of other things. But, you know, you want some institutionalized presence for the loyal opposition inside the Democratic Party. But, yeah, I think that takeover is eminently possible, and it would, you know, move the Democrats rather substantially on their views on national security and international economics, and use all the savings from that to invest a lot more in the working class at home. Yeah, I think there's a cosmopolitan nationalism which is available in national politics, which I think is Lynn's view too. I don't know Michael at all, but anyway, that's what I think the vital center is for American politics. You know, let's make this place a city on a hill. Let's not denounce it all the time as, you know, just collapsing all the time. Let's have some pride in America, but let's do so in a way which establishes the sort of community that, you know, we've always talked about in this country, and less and less plausibly, you know, is a place where birth doesn't determine fate, where democracy rules, and everybody's in, and we're stronger together. I don't want to repeat Hillary's slogans. I actually didn't mean to do that just again, but right. You know, but that's the progress of American history. It does get stronger the more inclusive you are.
Well, Joel, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Joel Rogers, who's a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's written widely on American politics and public policy in such books as On Democracy, Right Turn, The Forgotten Majority, What Workers Want, and most recently, American Society, How It Really Works. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the remarks by the former acting director of the CIA, Mike Morrell, who called Donald Trump an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Locke Johnson, who's the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the staffs of both House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees in the 1970s before he went into academia. He's the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security and has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security, Seven Sins of American Foreign Policy, and his latest book is The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Locke Johnson.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
And it seems that we're in this election season, we're into an unprecedented a debate on national security, where the former acting director of the CIA writes an op-ed in the New York Times suggesting that the Republican candidate for president of the United States is an unwitting agent of the Russian Federation. The tables have certainly turned, given that throughout the Cold War, it was always the Democrats who were defensive when the Republicans charged them of being soft on the Russians or the Soviets. Now the tables have turned, but in the most extraordinary way. Can you make sense out of this?
Well, I think it is rather extraordinary, and I would agree with you. The tables have turned, and I think this is partly due to the fact that Mr. Trump is so inexperienced in foreign policy, so the Democrats, for a change, look as though they know more about world affairs than the Republicans do, and certainly that would be the case at the level of the party nomination, because after all, the Democratic nominee was Secretary of State and a U.S. Senator who served on the Armed Services Committee. But I also think that what's going on here is that Putin and Trump are both businessmen. Putin, one might want to say unethical one, from what I hear. He's willing to do almost anything to make a deal. And Trump may not be quite that bad, but he's known to be interested in deal-making, too. So here are two individuals who have that in common. But maybe even more importantly, Putin is so anti-Hillary Clinton. And this is true because she's been very critical of him in the past, and she blamed him personally for putting down protest movements about a Russian election. And he's never forgiven her for that. And, of course, the Democratic Party generally has not been very favorable toward Putin. Even in today's New York Times, you'll find President Obama saying that in dealing with someone like Putin, one has to enter any understanding with a great deal of skepticism.
So is it possible, then, it's been puzzling to me why, if the Russians hacked the DNC and the Clinton Foundation, and it's worth noting that the most damaging thing that Hillary Clinton has endured has been the revelation of her private server, which has dogged her, and she's not been very effective in countering criticism on that front. The information that was first revealed, the existence of that server, was broken on RT, which is Putin's English-language propaganda outfit. It was based on a Romanian hacker, Guccifer, who'd hacked into the email of Sidney Blumenthal, and therefore, because he was exchanging emails with this private server, they revealed the server. So I've always been amazed that the press and the public in general don't make that link, that the most damaging thing about Hillary Clinton, the server, we only learned about it because of it was first broken by RT. So in general, I guess the question would be, when intelligence services break into other people's computers, they tend to lurk inside secretly. They disguise their entry and their exit, and they don't publicize it. Why then is Putin sort of publicizing it? Because they did leave markers and even aggressively sort of said, you know, screw you, America, you know, we're the Russians. So I guess what I'm asking here is, Putin basically doesn't mind having his fingerprints revealed on this? Is he basically wants the public to know that this is payback for Hillary Clinton?
Yes, I think you're right about that. And let me begin by commending you for the deep level of research and understanding that I think you have of this. I haven't seen anyone in the media really lay this out as well. I haven't seen anyone in government either. So I hope everyone is listening to your program, as many are, I know, and will begin to understand this better. I think in the case of Putin, he's a rather boastful man, I think. And he's really had it with the Democratic Party, and he's had it with Hillary in particular for some of the comments she's made about him in the past, but also President Obama. And they've tweaked him, and now he's tweaking back, I think. And he's proud of the fact that he can hack in like that, and it's a way of showing that the Russia's still a superpower, certainly when it comes to cyber attacks and cyber warfare. And so there's a bit of a caution that he's sending us about that, too, that, look, I'm just as strong as you are when it comes to the cyber world. But even more importantly, I think it's an opportunity for him to stick his chest out and say, well, now I got you back, didn't I? So maybe you ought to straighten out and quit harassing me on the world stage, and possibly I'll then calm down a bit myself. But until you do, expect that I'll be coming after you.
And again, I'm speaking with Locke Johnson, who's the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees and is the editor of the journal Intelligence and National Security, and has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence in America's Quest for Security, Seven Sins of American Foreign Policy. And his latest book is The Threat on the Horizon, an insider's account of America's search for security after the Cold War. So I recall the polonium poisoning of a dissident Russian intelligence officer who had gone to London and blown the whistle on Putin, particularly over how he rose to power with the bombing of the apartment buildings on the outskirts of Russia that appeared to be the work of the FSB and he was poisoned with polonium. You can't get polonium off the shelf. But in effect, what happened was Putin got it both ways. He was able to, you know, deny direct responsibility, at the same time send a signal to possibly dissident intelligence officers is that this is your fate if you cross me. So that has been his MO, and that's why I wonder, I suspect that what you just told us is accurate, that the fact that he wants the world to know what's going on here, that they are tipping the scales for Trump, and they are giving the Democrats, and particularly Hillary Clinton, payback, would certainly make sense in that context.
Yes, I think so, because imagine, let's wear Putin's moccasins, as the Navajos like to say, for a moment, and try and see world affairs from where he is in the Kremlin. And the idea of Hillary Clinton coming into the presidency must be quite discomforting to him, because after all, they have not been very friendly toward one another for quite a while now. Whereas Trump, whether or not he's an unwitting agent or not, has developed a bit of rapport, long-distance rapport, with Putin. And so surely him being elected would be much more favorable in terms of Moscow's ability to work with the United States and to develop trade relationships. So, yes, I mean, if foreign nations could manipulate our elections to their will, they'd love to do it. But it's quite, I must say, unsettling, chilling even, to think that a major power like Russia would be trying to manipulate our elections. It's a very serious and very, I think, major departure from the norm. Now, we have had in the past some incidents where the North Koreans or maybe the Chinese have been accused of providing funds to one candidate or another. And there was a big scandal many decades ago, I think maybe about 3 decades ago, about the South Koreans trying to use money on Capitol Hill to get their way. And we've reacted very strongly in all these incidents because we don't want, for obvious reasons, foreign powers to have any say in how we make our electoral choices.
So if this is the case where Putin is basically doesn't mind the world knowing that he's tipping the scales, I think in many ways the fact that he has a lobbyist, that he's campaign chairman, who has worked with both the Kremlin and the Kremlin's guy in Ukraine, who was kicked out in a popular revolt, he may be actually more active. I don't think Trump is particularly hands on with anything, but what Mike Morrell, the former acting director of the CIA, said, that he thinks that Putin, being a former intelligence officer, knew exactly how to target Trump's ego and his vulnerabilities, and he flattered him and lured him in that sort of version of what they used to call the honey trap, understanding the psychology of your opponent. Mm-hmm. Do you give that any credence?
Well, I do to some degree, but I don't think you have to be a former KGB officer or any kind of intelligence officer at all to figure out that maybe flattery will work in the case of Donald Trump. After all, have we ever seen such a gigantic narcissist on the world stage or in presidential elections in memory? So I don't think that necessarily one can trace that back to Putin's training as a KGB officer. But while in the KGB, certainly you'd learn some techniques of trying to manipulate foreign powers. We do it. Every other major country in the world tries to have its influence exerted in important situations overseas, either openly or secretly. So there's nothing new about that. But normally, when it comes to major nations, there's a kind of understanding that we don't, at least the United States doesn't try to intervene, and normally other countries don't as well. But I think Putin has realized that here's someone in Donald Trump that maybe he has some business connections with, or at least potentially would be willing to open up Russian-American trade more, and another egomaniac with whom he can relate. So I think that's what's mainly going on.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, historians and political scientists and I guess the public in general tend to look at history in terms of the big sweeps of policy and war and peace, etc. And without And I think you can make a strong case that so much of history is driven by personalities as opposed to policies. And in that context, given that you've got an absolute kind of czar in Russia, in Vladimir Putin, and we're basically talking about his personality here, because he, as a practical guy, you'd think he would not want to back a loser like Trump, given that Trump is plummeting in the polls. But it sort of makes sense in terms of personality. And to that extent, I think you could perhaps even criticize Hillary Clinton, because when they first met, it was pretty prickly. And in their first private conversations, she got around to talking to him about his stunts with, you know, flying with the cranes and right. rescuing the Siberian tigers. And he defended himself by saying he was a serious conservationist and invited her to go to Siberia with him. And then when it came to the picking up the invitation, she turned him down and said she was busy and had other things to do. Do you think those things are a mistake, that when you deal with these kind of egomaniacs, it's better to be friends with them? I mean, I guess we've never had this weird situation where you have the combination of organized crime and nuclear weapons before. That's a difficult thing to deal with. But if you're dealing with a gangster, which is pretty much what people conclude he is and the Siloviki around him are, one of the things that gangsters crave is respectability. So why not give him some respectability? Why put him in a corner?
No, Ian, I think you've really put your finger on an important point here. And I personally am appalled by the reaction of Hillary Clinton and President Obama toward Putin. I think the word gangster is apt in his case. But nonetheless, he's the head of a major power, and he has sufficient number of nuclear weapons to turn the United States into a heap of radioactive rubble. So this is a person that you have to try and deal with, and you have to make nice with, I think. Down here in the South, we say you catch more flies with honey. And I think you've got to put your personal distaste for someone like him aside, at least to some degree. I mean, you always have to be on guard, and you always have to make sure you're going to back up NATO, which, of course, Trump has really not done very well. And you have to be, you can't be naive about a man like that. But I think you've got to bend over backwards to try and get along with people who normally you wouldn't want to sit down and have a cup of coffee with.
Well, now we're hearing reports about how Putin is doing so well in Syria, how his foreign policy is working out so well for him, where he's managed to intervene in Syria very effectively without being sucked into a quagmire. And the press is making the comparison that the U.S. has been feckless because they've been afraid of being sucked into a quagmire.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it seems to me that what's not being stated here is that there's an asymmetry between a country like the United States, which is a democracy that operates on the rule of law and has transparency, and a country like Russia, where they can be ruthless. I mean, Putin right. rose to power by, as he said about the Chechens, "I'm going to choke them to death in the outhouse." And he then absolutely destroyed Grozny and did this very much the same tactics that they're using in Syria, where they bomb hospitals and clinics and anything.
Right.
They'll just do anything that's necessary to solve the problem, in quotes. So is that you think, is what is being missed here in the praise for Putin in Syria, which, you know, the Republicans have been piling on, saying how feckless Obama is. But is Obama constrained by the fact that we simply can't be as ruthless as the Russians are?
Well, we certainly can. I mean, don't want to be as ruthless as they are. After all, that's what makes our country so great, I think, is that we're so dramatically different from Russia in our belief in human rights and basic democratic principles. But at the same time, we can work with a place like Russia. And indeed, I don't think most Americans realize, but ever since the end of the Cold War in 1991, we've had regular meetings between their intelligence services and the CIA with a couple of common goals in mind, defeating terrorists around the world, stopping human trafficking, standing up against the international criminals who sell drugs and otherwise break laws. So we have those things in common, and even though they're despicable in many ways, and their leader is something of a thug, we have to, for the sake of our own security, put that aside to some degree and see where we can work together with them. And when it comes to Syria, I think the most important point here is that the world has not seen any organization since Adolf Hitler who's quite as venal as ISIS is, the Islamic State. I mean, these are people, as we all know, we've seen on TV, are prepared to do anything. Most brutal group of barbarians one can imagine. So we have to make sure that we can somehow work with Russia and, you know, all kinds of other people, Saudi Arabia, some of the other Islamic nations in that area, to carve up the territory where ISIS is and each take a part of it and go in there and destroy that nation before it spreads its terrible ideology even further. And it's disappointing to me that Obama, who has such incredible social skills and such a wonderful mind, is unwilling to put personal grievances aside and work with someone like Putin to come up with a strategy. Now we're beginning to do that a little bit, and Russian intelligence and the CIA are meeting on a regular basis now with respect to how we can defeat ISIS. Part of the problem, of course, is that we don't like Assad for good reasons, and some of the rebel groups are against Assad, so we find them attractive. But some of those same groups are also affiliated with al-Qaeda, so it's a real bind. But I think what we need to do is put everything else aside for the moment in that part of the world, join with the Russians and anyone else we can get to join us, and destroy the ISIS operation.
Well, look, Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure, and I hope we can talk again sometime.
Indeed. And again, I've been speaking with Locke Johnson, who's the Regents Professor of Political Science at the University of Georgia. He served on the staffs of both the House and Senate Intelligence Oversight Committees and is the author of the journal Intelligence and National Security, and has written several books on American foreign policy, including Bombs, Bugs, Drugs, and Thugs, Intelligence and America's Quest for Security, Seven Sins of American Foreign Policy. And his latest book is The Threat on the Horizon, an inside account of America's search for security after the Cold War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.